Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of April. Our guest this hour wrote in last week's New York Times, Wednesday's Supreme Court decision on campaign finance, a 5-4 decision which struck down overall limits on contributions by individuals to candidates and parties, took an expansive view of First Amendment rights and a narrow one of political corruption. Adam Liptak is our guest this hour, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, started covering the court in the fall of 2008 and has written Sidebar, a column on developments in the law, since 2007. Law degree is from Yale. After graduation, he spent 4 years at a New York City law firm as a litigation associate specializing in First Amendment matters. He has taught media law at the Columbia University School of Journalism, UCLA Law School, and Yale Law School. We're interested in your responses to this large decision that will affect campaign finance and perhaps elections in a significant way. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Adam. Thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Good to be back.
Yeah, great to have you here. Could you start just by giving us a little more background information on who McCutcheon is and why he brought suit?
McCutcheon's an Alabama businessman, a Republican Party activist, and he was frustrated by what, in a way, is a fairly odd federal law. There's a law that says you can't contribute more than $2,600 to a candidate per election, meaning $2,600 for the primary, $2,600 for the general election, total of $5,200 every 2 years. And that's not an issue in this case. He says that's okay with him. He's fine. He doesn't want to contribute more than $5,200 per candidate. But there's a separate federal limit saying you can't contribute, and I forget what the precise number is, about $45,000 across all candidates. So he says, I can give $5,200 to the first guy, to the second guy, to the third guy, but there comes a point at which I can no longer contribute to the additional candidate. Mm-hmm. And he says that doesn't make sense, that overall aggregate limit, and that if your fear is you're going to corrupt somebody, it's not clear why the 16th guy is corrupted when the 15th one wasn't by the $5,200. So he challenges this overall limit, but it's part of a litigation strategy to chip away at campaign finance regulation piece by piece. And when it went down the other day, the Supreme Court used some fairly expansive reasoning that may allow other kinds of campaign finance regulations to be attacked as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how many people in this country can afford to give that kind of money?
I've seen different numbers. I think some 600 people bumped up against the overall limits.
600?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. That's not very many people who are spending a whole lot of money, right?
It's not very many people, and now they're allowed to, you know, where they were capped out at $40,000 or so. If they wanted to give this amount to every single member of Congress, you quickly get into the millions.
Wow. You write, according to experts in election law you've spoken with, there is no reason to think that this march toward deregulating election spending will stop with this ruling. What's down the road?
Well, bear in mind that the Roberts Court, which has been in business since 2005, has had 7 campaign finance cases, and it knocked down the regulation every single time.
Oh, my.
So we have a track record.
Mm-hmm.
What's next may be, and people misunderstand this in light of Citizens United, corporations are still barred from giving money directly to candidates. They can put up TV ads in support of or in opposition to candidates, but the contribution ban, the absolute contribution ban of corporations to candidates remains in place. So that's possibly under attack. I mean, one fairly modest kind of lawsuit would be to say, listen, they can already spend millions on ads. What's so bad about subjecting them also to this $5,200 limit? You know, let corporations give money, but only to the same amount as individuals can. I can imagine that attack. I could imagine an attack on the individual contribution limit saying it's too low. $5,200 won't corrupt anybody. Why can't it be $25,000? And there are also limits on what you can give to political parties. There's a lot of talk that we actually would like our parties to have a larger role in elections, bring some of the dark money into the light, and let more moderate Republican and Democratic national parties play a role. So you might want to argue that some of those limits should be struck down. And then some campaign finance, call them reformers, are very scared that the court might go after public financing. They've already chipped away at public financing a little bit. They might go after that some more. So there's still lots of territory. There's lots of ways in which the Roberts Court could let more money flow into politics.
Whatever happened to McCain-Feingold?
Well, that's the law that gets that part of it's part of that law that got struck down the other day. Another part of that law got struck down in Citizens United. It's a big, complicated law. Some parts of it remain in place, but much of it is gone.
And why is it that we were in a time in the not-too-distant past where we thought, ooh, big money could probably corrupt, we need to look at this, and so we got campaign finance legislation?
Well, it's really a function of the horrors of the Watergate regime, where we saw people taking suitcases full of cash, and Congress responded quite vigorously in the mid-70s. And then the Supreme Court promptly sort of split the baby on that. It made two different categories, and this is really important to bear in mind. One category, the Supreme Court has long said about individuals, that they can spend what they want independently of candidates, that that's truly speech, that if they want to publish a book, make a documentary, or make a TV ad and put that up, that's speech, and they can do what they like. So individuals have, since Buckley v. Valeo in the 70s, been allowed to do that. Citizens United now said corporations and unions are allowed to make that kind of independent spending. The next frontier is direct contributions to candidates and parties.
Mm. And when you were talking about public finance, the reasoning behind eliminating public finance would be what, can you imagine?
Well, the court struck down an Arizona law. There was a public finance law, but a little odd. It said, we're going to give you money. If you won't take any private money, we'll give you some public money. And if your opponent spends more, we'll give you additional money. So it kind of escalated as the campaign went on. And the court said that kind of public finance law is no good because it chills the speech of the opponent, of the one taking private money. He or she's not going to want to talk because there will be counter speech in response. That, you know, that's a curious view of the First Amendment, which generally likes more speech. But anyway, having struck down that law, it's at least possible that the court would say it's no business of the government to try to level the playing field about speech, that that people should be able to speak as much as they want, and it shouldn't be the government's job to subsidize anybody's speech.
And yet, when the Chief Justice Roberts said in his decision, there is no right more basic in our democracy than the right to participate in electing our political leaders, did anybody on the court say, well, some may be able to participate a whole lot more than others might be able to? If you got a lot of money, you're participating at a greater level, and I would expect you would hope for a little something in return, right? Wouldn't you?
Right. Well, So there's a few things to say about that. One is Justice Breyer did issue, and from the bench, which is unusual, a very vigorous dissent. Justice Stevens, who's now retired but wrote the dissent in Citizens United, said, listen, in our courtroom, we give people 30 minutes for each side. We don't give the person with more money more time, more speech. And the counter argument to that is, do you really want the government to be deciding, you know, who's allowed to speak how much?
And what do we know about how much money will speak? There have been studies of this, haven't there?
Well, there's two kinds of things to be said about that. One is you have to think that people are rational, that they're spending money in a rational way, and campaign consultants and political activists absolutely believe that money matters.
Mm-hmm.
The political science on it is a little more complicated. It does seem to matter that you get a threshold amount of money, that you need to be able to get your message out enough that people can evaluate your message. There's some thinking, though, that there are diminishing returns as you get into very large numbers. And there are prominent examples of rich people who, you know, ran for Senate, say, in California, and vastly outspent their opponents and lost. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though it's a direct link. But, you know, if rational people are spending millions and millions on this, presumably they think they're getting something in return.
Well, I would imagine you would expect your phone calls to be answered and to have perhaps a little cup of coffee at least to talk about your issue. You would, wouldn't you?
Of course. So one is, does it help you get elected? The other question is, does it get you a hearing? And the Roberts Court takes a very, very narrow view of corruption. It says that ingratiation and access don't count. It's only if you can prove the equivalent of bribery, of quid pro quo corruption, that you can start to regulate these kinds of election spending. And I don't think that anybody disputes that you will get a hearing if you're a big contributor.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody in any of the arguments make reference to Watergate and why the first wave of reforms happened?
I don't remember that coming up at the arguments. I mean, the members of the court are old enough that they lived through it, and I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I don't have a vivid memory of it.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the makeup of this court. There's been a lot of discussion as to whether or not Supreme Court members are above politics. We keep seeing 5-4 decisions, and it was five Supreme Court members who had been appointed by Republican presidents. Is that significant at all? And the fact that the Republican National Committee was a sign-on to this McCutcheon suit?
Well, the justices will say that they're not political, and they're probably right in a limited sense. I don't think they typically pay attention to partisan political interests, but their ideological commitments are also political of a sort, and those ideological jurisprudential commitments map on pretty nicely to where the parties are in this particular case. So you did have every Republican-appointed member of the court voting in favor of a plaintiff in the case, the Republican National Committee, and every Democrat-appointed justice going the other way. So that doesn't seem random.
Adam Liptak is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. We're looking at the big Supreme Court decision last week concerning campaign finance. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter @KDunnShow. Adam is the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. And let's go to Michael in Wisconsin. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wanted to see if the guest would address the two things that I keep hearing people say that the court said in Citizens United. First, that money equals speech. The second one being that corporations are people. Best I can tell from looking at that decision and really looking at the history, neither of those is true. It seems like kind of a caricature of what the court actually said. Definitely corporate personhood is a tradition, going back in tort law and such, going back. But I don't believe the Supreme Court has ever said either of those things, and it kind of serves to take away the very serious free speech arguments that the Supreme Court has made in that decision and recently in the McCutcheon decision. I'll take the comment off air.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Michael is quite right. Citizens United has been badly caricatured on the left. The Supreme Court has long held in 20 or so decisions, including many involving the corporation I work for, the New York Times Company, that corporations have the benefit of some constitutional rights and that you can't take those rights away without good reason. It's also true that money equals speech is a very, very reductive way to think about things. If you want to speak effectively, if we want to publish a newspaper, if you want to publish a book or a pamphlet, if you want to make a documentary, you have to spend money to do that, to distribute it, or a TV ad. So if you say, speak all you want, but nobody can hear you, you've effectively tamped down on speech. So these issues are not easy, and there are good First Amendment arguments to say that what the First Amendment protects most, what's at the core of the First Amendment, is speech about politics, and that the more voters can hear different ideas and evaluate them for themselves, the better off they are. There's a long First Amendment tradition of that kind of thinking.
Hmm. I'm interested if you know this, Adam. We already have so incredibly much money in politics, and it would seem that most of that goes into the great chunk of it goes into advertising on television, and it's become so omnipresent that when there are major elections, the TV drives you crazy because you're seeing the same thing every 2 minutes. And
right.
I don't quite understand how everybody thinks that it's a good idea to spend more and more and more and more for more and more ads, which eventually people are going to turn off, or maybe they don't.
Well, that goes back to the good question you asked a couple minutes ago about how effective this kind of money is. What the money is spent on are these ads, you know, particularly in the era of digital video recorders and TiVo and the Internet and so on. I'm not even sure they get watched all that much. And is it effective to air the same ad 50, 100, 1,000 times?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think your intuition and mine is that you get some diminishing returns. And I would also hope that they're not effective in a second sense, which is just because someone says something with spooky music, I don't think you or I are necessarily inclined to believe it.
Somebody must. I guess somebody must. The only advantage you seem to see, well, it's obvious that one side has more money than the other, and some of the ads start so early. I mean, they've started for the gubernatorial race in Wisconsin ages ago
yes.
already, and you're thinking, come on, the election isn't until November, and it's primarily, you know, one side that appears to have all the money because they're running most of the ads.
Right. Now, I think the press is also guilty of fueling the idea that the one with the most money must be making the most headway.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a horse race aspect to it, the same way as you see when the movies come on Monday morning, people review which movie made the most money, which is not the only way to evaluate the quality of a movie either.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the McCutcheon decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last week, what it means, a little background on who McCutcheon is, and what may happen as a result of this decision, what will be before the court in the not-too-distant future, and what do we read from their decisions now on campaign spending and what it might mean for the future. So that's what's on our agenda this hour. Adam Liptak is our guest, Supreme Court correspondent of the New York Times. Hour two of our program today, there was a report out earlier this week that shows that spending on sports programs, we already knew that it was a big thing in Division I schools. Evidently, it's a really big thing in Division II and III schools as well. And this report from the American Association of University Professors is critical of this, saying that education, higher education, has lost focus on academic activities, that competitive athletics is too easily diverting the focus of our institutions. The executive director of the Knight Commission, who also heard a lot of testimony about payment of coaches and the amount of money that Division I schools are paying on major sports, it may also be too much. So the executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics will be joining us to talk about that issue. Here's our phone number for you to join this conversation. Do you think this was a big deal, this decision that was made by the Supreme Court? Does it make a difference how much money can be spread over how many candidates? Do people who have, and it's a small number of Americans, does it buy people influence in any way? Does it lead to corruption of our political system, of our voting system, or is it a basic right in our democracy to participate in electing our political leaders, and it's good to get rid of some of these restrictions? What do you think about this? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show, and lines are open for you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls, more of them for Adam Liptak. He is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and Scott in Whitewater is our next caller. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, thank you. 2 points. The first one is on the Citizens United, and if there's been any discussion on this, is if corporations can be treated as people and as individuals, why can't people be treated as corporations? You know, why can't I incorporate myself and, you know, if I lose money, if I have more of a mortgage, and why can't I deduct that from my income as a business expense the way a corporation does? And at the same time, if I get taxed at 38% or 32% as a working laborer, and then an individual gets taxed at 15% capital gains because all their money is capital gains, their speech gets taxed at a lower rate than my speech.
So people do incorporate. Many lawyers, dentists, doctors do incorporate. And while you can't take your personal living expenses as deductions, you can take your professional expenses as deductions. So it's not perfectly symmetrical, but there's a lot of overlap.
Marion is next in Madison. Hi, Marion.
Hello. I vehemently disagree with your guest. I think that we're looking at the destruction of democracy. We're going to have an oligarchy system because saying that money is speech says that only those with wealth can talk loud, that those who have no wealth, their speech doesn't count. And I so disagree with that. And I think this goes back to the early 1990s when the court first said that money was speech. Just right here in Wisconsin, I abhor the fact that there are two millionaires in Texas who have great influence and they're spending great amounts of money to change the politics in my state. That's not their business. It should be limited to the locale where you are living. If they want to influence Texas, fine. They don't belong here.
Adam.
That's a very widely held and powerful view. I guess another way to look at it, though, is media corporations are also corporations, and they speak all the time. And if Fox News and the New York Times, both based in New York, would have a view about what voters in Texas might like to do about their elected representatives in Texas, it would be a serious First Amendment problem to tell them that because they're corporations, they can't speak.
Mm-hmm. It is an indication, though, of where the money is going. I mean, there is so much of it now that people who are living in states very far away are influencing legislation that's important or issues that are important in a certain state. It's quite remarkable, isn't it?
It is, and there's also a fear that you might have foreign money coming into our elections. So it's a difficult problem.
Yeah. Thank you, Marion, very much for your call. Clyde in Clyde in Cedarburg. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much. I have two questions. I've written and studied on this issue for a number of years, and I have two specific questions. And then if I can't have a follow-up, then I would like to give my suggestion of the answer to the questions. One, the first question is, does anything in the U.S. Constitution itself specifically and incontrovertibly either establish or refute the legal theory that a corporation legitimately possesses any constitutional rights, and particularly the constitutional rights that were explicitly defined there as the rights of a person or the rights of the people? So that's the first question. Does the Constitution itself either establish or refute that? And if so, please, where is it? This question and the next one are worthwhile for all of us to think about, not just for the for your guests. The second question is, in which Supreme Court cases, if any, has the Supreme Court actually examined the question of whether corporations have constitutional rights and explained their reasoning clearly in their deciding, concurring, or dissenting opinions? My point on the second question is, I think it is, I'm not certain of this, but I believe that there is no place because what they do is refer to precedent, and the precedent, and then the precedent itself, or the case which is considered the precedent, which is an 1886 Supreme Court case. In that case, the Supreme Court itself actually did not consider that question either. In fact, it specifically said in its ruling that we are not ruling on any constitutional issues in this ruling.
All right. Thanks, Clyde. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. So that's a lot. The caller is right that the word corporation doesn't appear in the Constitution, but nor is it clear what the phrase Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press means. It doesn't assign that to any particular kind of entity, and there's long-held First Amendment views that it's not only the rights of the speaker that are in play, but that that listeners want to know, too. So I guess I'm interested in what General Motors has to say. I might well disagree with it, but I'm eager to hear it, and I'm not sure that it's a great idea as a First Amendment matter to shut them up. The second question is which precedent? Well, certainly long before Citizens United, in a case called Bellotti, the court said that corporations have First Amendment rights to spend not on behalf of candidates, but on behalf of referendums. So it's not a particularly new thought. Whatever can be said about how well-rooted in precedent it is, and the caller's right that it's not especially well-rooted in precedent, nor is it a novel idea that sprung out of Citizens United.
Mm. And what use was made of precedent in arguments on the McCutcheon case? Any?
It's in the nature of Supreme Court argument to try to argue from precedent. There, the key precedent was Buckley v. Valeo in 1974, which distinguished, as we discussed, between independent spending and direct contributions, and the suggestion was that that precedent had not been fully thought out, and that in fact these are both forms of speech. Mm. And the justices weren't ready to go that far, but they did think that this one kind of limit of aggregate contributions didn't satisfy First Amendment scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Was there, I can't remember if there was a constitutional challenge to McCain-Feingold, was there?
Yes, there was. So here's an important point. So in a case called McConnell v. FEC, the Supreme Court, 2003, not long ago at all, upheld essentially every part of McCain-Feingold. And that was when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was still on the court. And that was at a time when the justices were not perfectly aligned with the party of their appointing president, because Justice O'Connor, of course, was appointed by President Reagan. But she was much more sympathetic to campaign finance regulation than her successor, Justice Samuel Alito. So that switch in 2006 completely changes the landscape, and that's when we have these seven decisions in a row deregulating campaign finance and letting more money into politics.
Yeah. Thanks, Clyde, for your call. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Before I go on to my comment, I'd just like to throw in a quick comment that just based on the last callers, that the first 100 years of Supreme Court rulings, there's virtually nothing to speak of around corporate speech or free speech as it relates to anything other than individual. So just kind of interesting that the first cases came up with the industrialization in the late 1800s. Anyway, the comment I wanted to make is, you know, I understand the difficulty around the sheer limiting of money and all that entails. But what I don't understand are what are the constitutional entanglements of having us have a very clear understanding of who it is that is actually speaking. Mm-hmm. Whether they do so through a corporation or through a political action committee, you know, I want to know who's funding it. You know, I want to, if I see the byline that it says farmers against ethanol, I'd like to know if David Koch is funding 99% of that speech. And that's the kind of thing that I think we really need to get to, is how do we understand the full political message unless we understand all of the components of the message? And that includes who is it that's doing the speaking in the first place.
Yeah, interesting point. Adam?
I think that's a very strong point, and I completely agree. In the same way that I read the newspaper, I want to know whose byline it is, what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
As a First Amendment matter, it matters. But here's another overlooked part of Citizens United. The question of the disclosure law at issue there was before the court, and 8-1, they upheld it. 8-1, they said disclosure is a great idea. And the Chief Justice, again, in McCutcheon, said, I'm in favor of disclosure. Disclosure can cure a lot of problems. Now, it's true that the existing disclosure laws are quite weak and not likely to change, but that's not the Supreme Court's fault. The Supreme Court has said, Congress, if you guys are ready to order more disclosure, we are ready to uphold it. We're not going to stand in your way. Now, some might say that that's a cynical view on the Supreme Court's part because they know Congress, and particularly this Congress, is not going to act. But as a matter of theory, they're in favor of disclosure, and in my view, correctly so. It's very important to know who's doing the talking. We did have a recent example, which has gotten some people conflicted, where the president, chief executive, whatever he was, of the internet search company Mozilla, had disclosed his campaign contribution against Prop 8 and ended up losing his job. And there are people who think that there are problems with disclosure because they might give rise to some kinds of backlash.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your good points, Mike. Our phone number lines are open for you right now. We're talking about the McCutcheon decision last week, and our guest has written about it and written about campaign finance and the Supreme Court for quite some time. He is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. I would think, just to go to Congress here for a moment, Adam, that if you were a member of Congress, you would just get darn sick and tired of having to be on the phone arranging all these meetings with people who have money. And obviously, you have to court people who have money because you need huge amounts to get elected. You would think that they would, most of them, no matter what their political persuasion, would say, we've had enough of this. Give us another system.
Right. And to an extent, the McCain-Feingold Act was an attempt to do that. And the Supreme Court says in response that it's a kind of incumbency protection, that people don't want their opponents to be able to raise a lot of money. So there's complicated cross currents all across the way. And I'm not very close to that branch of government. I covered, you know, the court and not Congress. But my sense is that you're right, that they spend, you know, half the day making calls, raising money.
Yeah.
It's just, even if, I mean, it's just unseemly.
I know. Who would want to do that? In a sign of how cynical some of us have become, Tim and Racine wonders, is it possible that the Supreme Court justices have been bought off? Honest question, Tim says. Are there any rumors or investigation? Is there recourse if they have been?
There are no rumors like that. And, you know, cynical though reporters sometimes are, my own view is that these are earnestly held and principled positions on the part of the justices in the majority. Obviously, if that kind of bribery were established, impeachment resignation would not be out of the question. And we have an example of that in relatively recent history where Abe Fortas's financial affairs caused him to step down from the court.
Peter in Elm Grove, hi.
Yes, hello. I'm sorry I came to the hour late here, but I'm not sure if anybody said this. But I really honestly think that you can eliminate a lot of these huge political contributions by making a certain amount that if you go over this, your contributions are taxed at 60%. You can raise revenues for the governor or for the government and cut out these massive donations, because the people who are going to make them are going to choke on the fact that they have to pay 60% of what they're giving to the government.
So I'm not an expert on tax law, but there's an old saying that the power to tax is the power to destroy. And if you start to apply the tax law in a way that burdens constitutional rights, you run into problems. So I think it's a very nice, innovative idea. I'm not sure it would survive court scrutiny.
Thanks, Peter, very much for your call. More calls in just one moment with Adam Liptak. We're talking about the last Wednesday Supreme Court decision on campaign finance and welcoming your thoughts on all of this. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, more of them. We have a lot of them this hour. Pete and Racine. Hi, Pete.
Hi there. I'm thinking that it's not a matter of freedom of speech. It's more like a big poker game. I've seen in plenty of cowboy movies where somebody lays a bunch of money on a table, and the other guy, he just can't call his opponent's cards. He can't even display his own cards. There's no freedom of speech there at all. So basically, it's all a big poker game. It's not an issue of freedom of speech anymore.
It's all a big poker game, Adam.
I think that's a nice metaphor, and it goes to the point you were making a second ago, Kathleen, that one reason people raise so much money at the beginning and put up the ads so early in the cycle is probably to scare away other people from the table.
Yeah. Thank you, Pete, very much for your call. Jerry Ann on Facebook says, for anyone, including the five majority on the Supreme Court, who truly believes or would like others to think that they believe that money doesn't exert a major influence on politics, politicians, and national policy, I have only one thing to say that shoots down that assertion, the NRA.
That's probably true. The NRA also has people who are not only committed as a matter of money, but also committed as a matter of passion and ideology. So if you get the NRA behind you, it's not only because they're making some contributions. And I don't know the answer to this, but I suspect in the greater scheme of things, not that huge, but they can mobilize a base that cares very deeply about these issues.
So there are two things going on. Yeah. Bob in Wausau, hi. Hey,
Hello?
Bob.
Are you on the air?
You are, Bob. Go right ahead.
I'm kind of wondering what Europe and the rest of the world thinks of our adoption of money being the proper way to handle politics.
Yeah, I was thinking about that yesterday. Does any other country in the world do it this way, Adam?
Great question. I don't know every country, but the countries I'm aware of, and in particularly Great Britain and Canada, don't do it remotely like this. If short election seasons, very, very tough limits on campaign spending, and what we used to have in a way on the airwaves of a fairness doctrine of trying to make sure that both sides get their message before the public in a free and fair and equal kind of way.
Mm. Yeah, there's another thing. You could get us going on the fairness doctrine in all of this, too. Has the landscape ever changed in that regard over the last 30 years?
Yep.
Woo. Thanks, Bob, for your call. Dave in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Okay, my point is I own retirement funds. I own stock in these corporations, yet they do not ask my permission to spend money on political candidates I probably disagree with. I think they should be required to get stockholders' permission.
Adam.
I like that idea, and the Supreme Court has been quite hypocritical in this area, where when unions try to spend money on political activity, the court insists that union members sign off on that. And yet when corporations want to spend money on political activity, shareholders are not consulted. Now, you could imagine trying to recast the bylaws of a corporation to require that, but it's not required by law.
Thank you very much for the call. You had mentioned in one of your recent columns that there were a group of justices who were meeting last Friday to decide if they were going to take some Iowa case. Can you tell us more about that?
So Iowa has a law that, one, like federal law, bans all contributions from corporations to candidates. But then it has a wrinkle. It does allow contributions from unions to candidates. And the same lawyer who was behind the McCutcheon case, last Wednesday's case, challenged that Iowa law and said, A, it's not fair because corporations can't contribute, but unions can. But B, the ban on corporate contributions should fall. And people were afraid that the Supreme Court, in its steady march toward campaign regulation, would snatch up this case, but they announced on Monday they would not be hearing.
Oh, they did. And is it because, as you suggest, it's too close on the heels of, some would say, not completely popular Citizens United decision?
They don't say why they don't take cases, but I think probably there was enough excitement in this particular area for just now that they're going to take a breather and come back in some other way.
Yeah. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Sarah in Winona. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
You had a previous caller ask where in the Constitution does it allow corporations to have these rights? And your speaker touched on Supreme Court decisions. Over the past 150 years, there's been a number of Supreme Court decisions that have given powers to the corporations that were previously only in the hands of the people. In 1886, the 14th Amendment, which was created to give free slaves personhood rights, the Supreme Court allowed to be used for corporations as well. And throughout the 1880s, a number of Supreme Court decisions took away the previous restrictions allowing for funding campaign and funding nonprofits and so on. And a previous caller had also suggested that the people's votes should count more than the corporations. And the way we do that is through our dollar, how we spend our dollar, how we invest our dollar. And I'd also urge your listeners to get on the Internet and look into a community rights movement. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Adam?
I don't think it's such a radical idea. I mean, you know, this seems to be going against the trend of many of the questions, that at least some constitutional rights have to apply to corporations. I don't think we would believe that corporations' property could be taken without due process, say. It's a corporate right. The other thing I guess I'd say is, yes, it's obviously true that it's fairly recent that any of these rights were recognized, because the idea of the corporate form itself is relatively recent. It was not known at the time of the founding. Now, you can argue from that therefore the founders didn't intend to cover corporations. But is it really very different that three people get together and say, I'm going to put up an ad because I think Joe Blow is going to be a great candidate, and they're going to put their money together, and if they do it as individuals, they can put up the ad. If they do it as a partnership, they can put up the ad. If they do it as some kind of unincorporated association, they can put up the ad. But the moment they decide to form a corporation, they can't anymore. It's not obvious that's where you want to draw the line.
Hmm. What do you think about this person you quoted in your article, Professor, I can't remember the first name, Gurgan, law professor at
Heather,
Yale.
Right.
Heather, right, Professor Heather Gurgan. The court sometimes, she says, seemed blind to the real-world consequences of its rulings. We want judges to be shielded from politics, but we don't want them to be naive about politics.
So there's a hot debate in the legal academy now about whether the Roberts Court is, you know, has bought into a theory without thinking through what the real world consequences are and is naive, as Professor Gurgan says, or whether they're in fact completely cynical and they know exactly where this stuff is going to lead. They just don't want to say so.
Hmm. Where do you fall?
I think that this is a very savvy court. And I think they know well how, you know, who this helps and who this hurts.
Hmm. I think it was E.J. Dionne who said in his commentary, really analysis of the Supreme Court decision, that it's another sign of where politics are at play here. And when people reach the high court, he is hopeful for a day when they forget their party allegiance. We need to stop peddling the fiction that there isn't a party allegiance. I guess our hope as Americans is that you're going to have these really deep thinkers who have no party allegiance, who have terrific minds, and are going to think deeply and look at precedent on all of these issues and not be as predictable as this court seems to be.
Well, you know, this court is actually distinctive. It's the first court, apparently, in American history where the party of the appointing president perfectly predicts voting in these ideologically charged cases. It really was not long ago. Think back to the three most recent retirees, Justice Stevens, appointed by President Ford, mm-hmm. a Republican, mm-hmm. and yet quite liberal, really the leader of the Republican of the liberal side of the court. Justice O'Connor, we talked about, appointed by President Reagan, a moderate trending to the left in her later years, and David Souter, appointed by the first President Bush, also quite liberal. So as you suggest, it didn't used to be that that these things were perfectly predictable. And when Gerald Ford, post-Watergate, decides to appoint Justice Stevens, the only instruction he gave to his attorney general was, find me the best lawyer in America.
Really? Oh, that's fascinating. Who says that these days, do you think? Does anybody? Find me the best lawyer in America.
What they say these days is, find me someone who's going to vote the way I
want. Right.
And, yeah. And you know, the second George Bush presidency, very controversial, but it has real lingering effects on the Supreme Court, because the appointment of the Chief Justice and of Justice Alito have really changed the texture of that court.
Mm, yeah. Greg is our next caller in Glidden. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Why can't we just elect these justices the same way we elect congressmen, senators, and governors? And then I think there should be term limits in the Supreme Court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
As a matter of policy, a lot of people would agree with you. Most states elect most of their judges. Those aren't always pretty elections either. But the Constitution does call for, certainly calls for appointed federal judges and calls for life tenure.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg, for the call. Ken in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. I wonder about the principle of one person, one vote. Is that established in law or in
case history.
Mm.
That's a consequence of a Warren Court innovation.
Hmm.
Baker v. Carr was the case that insisted on that in every election, state and federal, with one exception, the Senate. The Senate continues to violate one person, one vote by like a factor of 50, so that a voter in Wyoming has 20 times the voting, 20, 30, 40 times the voting power of a voter in California. So with the exception of the Senate, we do have one person, one vote, but it's not in the Constitution. It's an interpretation of the Constitution by the Warren Court.
Thanks, Ken. Chris in Madison. Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering with Justice Roberts' statement about that they need to get more people involved and they can't keep people from getting involved in the political process, how that would apply to the Republicans' nationwide voter suppression that they have ongoing.
There does seem to be a tension. Yeah, I agree with you. There seems to be a tension between that statement and not only what is happening on the ground, but the reason it's happening on the ground is because of June's decision in Shelby County versus Holder, where the Supreme Court strikes down a core provision of the Voting Rights Act and allows more of the kind of activity you're talking
mm-hmm.
about.
And I'm wondering, that's the case in Wisconsin, and we're waiting for a state court decision and also a federal court decision. When do those issues reach the Supreme Court? Early voting restrictions, voter ID, will that happen next session of the court or not?
I don't know of any case pending on its so-called cert docket, cert for petition for certiorari, where they're deciding what case to take next. Although it would not surprise me if in the next term, the one that starts in October and ends in June of 2015, we might see some of those cases.
Mm, interesting. And I'm wondering, when we look at how all of this affects, to the thought follows from your interview with the Yale professor, what happens, what are the real-world consequences of these decisions when it comes to individual participation, individual contributions, those $5 and $10 and $20 and $25 contributions to the person you'd like to have elected to whatever the position is? Do those start to shrink?
I don't know the answer to that. I'd be curious about your thoughts. I suppose the person who might have been, and you remember the Obama campaign, particularly the first one,
right,
got a ton of those small
yeah.
contributions. You have two things could happen. One is I'm offended by how much the big guys are giving,
right,
therefore I'm going to give more. Or you may think the big guys are going to swamp me anyway. What's the point? And it's hard to know, but to go back to the voting rights analogy for a second, it was the case that voter turnout seemed to increase in some of those places where there were efforts to cut back on things like early voting.
Mm-hmm.
That people were offended and they said, darn it, I'm going to go out and vote just despite them.
Mm. So that could be perhaps one of the consequences for the midterm elections? I don't know.
It's conceivable.
Yeah, it is. Well, what are you writing about next, sir?
Oh, we got some good cases coming up. We have a case that's sort of along these lines being argued April 22nd about whether Ohio is allowed to have a law that prohibits lies in political ads.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my. Well, that would
How do you think that's going to come
Yeah, out? That's real interesting. And determine what the lies are will be interesting.
Right.
Adam, thank you so much for
great
being
to
with
be
us. Thanks. It was a great hour. Adam Liptak, our guest this hour, Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, talking about last week's Supreme Court decision, the McCutcheon case, which was an interesting one. He's an interesting guy, too. He has been writing this sidebar column. It's on developments in the law, and he's done that for quite a few years now. His law degree from Yale. He spent 4 years at a firm in New York City after graduating as a litigation associate specializing in First Amendment matters. Has taught media law at the Columbia University School of Journalism and the UCLA Law School and Yale Law School. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, and this is particularly timely after all the money that was spent and all the people who watched the Final Four and all of March Madness, there's a report that came out this Monday that shows that college spending on athletic programs is increasing at a faster rate than that of academics. And this particular report focused not on Division I schools, but Division II and III. They're using it as a recruiting tool. Are we putting our emphasis on the wrong thing? It should be we're spending a lot more money on academics, and a sidebar would be athletics instead of the other way. We'll talk about that. Hour two of the show, shortly after the news.